Thank you again, Jacob. One other announcement I did forget to make is we remember last week we talked about our neighbor over here who helped us with our air conditioning. We do have a card on the back, a table, so if you all will sign that, we'll give that to him, and we have a little gift card for him too, show a little bit of our appreciation. Well, happy birthday, America. You know, we are extremely blessed to live in a great nation, a nation that we do with such a great history. When America was very young, the famous political philosopher, if I pronounce your name right, is Alexis de Tocqueville, I believe is how you pronounce your name. Anyway, she visited the shores of America. She wanted to learn the very secret, the secret that enabled a handful of what seemed like just small, innocent people defeat a mighty British Empire. The travel, actually that's a he, I'm sorry, but his travel took him across the land from shore to shore, from sea to sea. He noticed the greatness of the harbors. He noticed the fertility of the ground, the plush fruits and vegetables that grew, the boundless force. He took all this into account. He studied our school system. He studied our military. He studied our Congress. He even went so far as to study our Constitution. But still, he could not find what the secret was. Could not understand it. It was not until he went into the churches that he found the answer, at least the answer that he was looking for. When he returned to Europe, he wrote this warning to all the Europeans. He wrote this: America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. He put that warning out. America, and I use this term lightly, but is a great nation. But America is great because America was founded on and had always tried to do the right thing. America opened its doors to all those in other lands, remembering that it was those people that made up who America became, who America is. America is great because it is, and this is a fact, it is still one of the most generous nations in the world, giving untold millions in aid to third world countries. Now, it does a lot of other stuff, too, that maybe is not so great, but we're not talking about that today. It sends its people to other countries to feed, to care for them, to offer medical, to offer religious advice, to feed the starving world in whatever way they're hungering. America is great because it allows its people the freedom to choose who and where they worship. It's also great because it still takes the side of the little guy. America is against the bullies of the world. America has learned that greatness is not measured through silver and gold, through rivers and forests. It's not measured even through the bombs and the missiles that they house. Greatness is an inner quality. It's found in what we are rather than what we have or what we possess. America is noted for that very special icon, that lady that stands in New York Harbor. When people come over, they very boldly see this statue proclaiming freedom. Think about that, proclaiming freedom with her flame lifted up for everybody to see. This was a gift from the French. She still inspires even those who were not born here. America's flag waves boldly in this free air that you and I breathe. It's a symbol of all that makes America great when you understand what the collars mean, the men and women who lived and died for that very freedom. Whether this flag is waving at a ball game, a political rally, a concert, a worship service, it still sends chills up and down our spine when we look at it and we think about it for what it really is. One of our nation's founding documents, and we all know this, is called the Declaration of Independence. I want to share just a few words from the Declaration of Independence as we get started here today. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness. What an absolute beautiful statement to open any type of governing document with. Brethren, we truly have been blessed to be in a nation with the freedoms that America has or had. It's very interesting that our nation's founders, they realized the very importance of basing that freedom that we enjoy today on the same set of laws that God gave Moses back at Mount Sinai. When you think about that and think about where we are today, it seems like we've come a world traveling from where we started just 200 plus years ago. You can just about look any place in Washington. If you haven't been there, it's well worth the trip. You can just about look any place, any buildings in Washington that you go to, in Washington, D.C., and you will find scriptures, evidence of scriptures, written on almost every famous building. These include the Capitol building, the very site where the Supreme Court meets. The Supreme Court, we know what's happened in the past 6 months, 12 months. That very Supreme Court, that's where they meet. So picture this. If you've been there, you'll be able to draw your mind's eye in this real easy. But you're walking up to the Capitol. You go around the pond in front. I call it a pond. It's a pool of water. You see in front of you a huge mountain of steps. You start climbing those steps. And as you do that, you glance up to the top of the building, the very Capitol building, Capitol, the United States of America. And on top of that, you see a row of statues. These rows of statues, they're all turned inward just a little bit. These statues represent all of the world's great lawgivers. That's what their intent was to be. And each of these, again, facing inward, are facing a center statue. This center statue is in the middle, facing forward, boldly forward. This middle statue is said to be the one of Moses with the Ten Commandments. As you enter the Capitol and you go into the Supreme Court, there's two huge oak doors. And engraved in the bottom of these oak doors, in the lower portion of these doors, you'll see something else. You'll see an engraving of two tablets of stone, again, representing the Ten Commandments. And if you were to go inside the Supreme Court courtroom and sit down, you could see on the wall, right above where the Supreme Court judges all sit, again, a display of what is symbolized as the Ten Commandments. Now, why do you suppose they designed the Supreme Court in this manner? Well, it's because as a nation of free people, and that was what we were founded on, we find that the intent of these law givers, these law builders, the intent was to base their principles off of the laws of God. That was the intent. As we get into our topic this afternoon, we'll find that the people of Israel that came to the mountain of God, they wanted this very same thing, this freedom. And they were about to see what freedom really cost. They were about to see how to achieve this act of freedom, the very act that God was about to give them. This was where the Ten Commandments were to be given from God. If you will, I just want to start with Deuteronomy 5. So if you will, let's notice the first few words here in Deuteronomy chapter 5 and read verse 6. Deuteronomy 5, verse 6. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's where he starts. Think about that. They've just been brought out of the house of slavery. They've just been given freedom. Now, maybe if we've never been in bondage, we might not appreciate that. But try to imagine these people who went through what they did. 400 years of indebtedment to Egypt. They were given freedom. Once they were slaves, now they were free people. God made them free. Now they were on their way to the promised land. That was the whole point here. This is a land that would be for them a land of freedom for the rest of their life. But on the way to this land of freedom, God had stopped them here at this mountain to give them this laws that would change their life. They were here to receive God's laws. And this law was going to be the foundation, the very foundation of the blessings and the freedom that God was about to give them. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 28, if you will. Deuteronomy chapter 28, because in Deuteronomy chapter 28 here, God tells them what will be the result if they obey these laws. Deuteronomy chapter 28, starting in verse 2 through 9, it says, "You'll be blessed in the city and blessed in the country. Your descendants will be blessed, and your soil's produce and the offspring of your livestock, including the young of your herds and the newborn of your flocks. Your baskets and kneading bowls will be blessed. You will be blessed when you come in and blessed when you go out. The Lord will cause the enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you. They will march out against you from one direction, but flee from you in seven directions. The Lord will grant you a blessing on your storehouses and on everything that you do. He will bless you in the land and the Lord your God, the land the Lord your God is giving you. The Lord will establish you as His holy people, as He swore to you, if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in His ways." Well, it seems simple enough, right? I mean, all you have to do is take these 10 little laws and live by them. We are not living by these 10 little laws today. We are trying. I say we, I'm using that kind of broadly. I hope we, as Christians are, but we as America, we are not. God was promising Israel here that His law, the law that He was giving them at that time, this would be the foundation, the very thing that their life from here on out would be built on, the foundation of their freedom, and the foundation of their blessings as God's people. All they had to do is accept them and live by them. God's merciful, but God means what He says. There's a book called None of These Diseases, and it's written by two doctors, S.I. McMillan and David E. Stern. Again, both of these are MDs. And when they wrote this book, they focused on God's promises to Israel, that if they obeyed God, then they wouldn't have experienced the diseases, or as many of them at least, that had plagued Egypt. And I think it's interesting when you hear a little bit about this. These authors, they go to great lengths to point out that the diseases that Israel would have been spared by if they'd only obeyed God's laws would have been far less than what they actually ended up with. For example, in our present culture, the idea, and this has gone extremely rapid today, sexual purity, it's laughed at. It's a joke, and that's a shame. It's a shame that it's a joke in society, let alone in the church, but it's a joke. And yet, this very thing was something that the law focused heavily on for Israel and for all of us. So, what has been the result of our nation ignoring and mocking God on this law, as well as others? Well, since the 60s, the number of STDs has skyrocketed and has become the leading health concern for our nation, the leading health concern. Then there were God's laws concerning cleanliness and sanitation that would spare Israel plagues and mass infections. Back in 1840, the medical center, it was in Europe. It was in Vienna, Austria. If someone had a major disease or an illness or some kind of a problem, then this was the place to go. You know, maybe you could compare it today to the Mayo Clinic, because this was a place to go, because this was on the cutting edge. They knew what was happening, and they could take care of things. Well, in that day, there was a young doctor stationed here, and his name, again, if I can pronounce this right, it was Ignaz Semmelweis. I probably butchered that, But I think that's who he was. But his area here of oversight in this medical facility was a maternity ward for this entire hospital. But there was a problem that deeply concerned him. The percentage of death in this ward was extremely high. Now, keep in mind, this is 1840. One out of every six women that was in this ward died during or after childbirth. And they called it childbed fever. Maybe we've heard of it, I don't know. And no satisfactory explanation could be found. So Dr. Semmelweis, he decided to watch the doctors who treated these women and observe everything they did with minute detail. He discovered that these physicians, in their daily rounds, the very first stop of the morning was the morgue. He went to the morgue. They would examine these dead bodies. And of course, at that time, they didn't wear rubber gloves. And they never washed their hands. They didn't see a need. They didn't put two and two together. So there was no seeming need to do this. They carried on day-to-day obligations. Once they had finished examining a corpse and doing everything they did, they would make their way straight on down the hall or up the hall or wherever it was to the maternity ward and then examine the women and the babies. So you and I can understand why there'd be such a high death rate. These expectant mothers, they didn't have a chance. But Dr. Semmelweis, he was the first doctor to study this and make the connection and begin to institute the idea of washing hands. It seems like a no-brainer, but they didn't do it. So he put this policy into being. And you know what happened? The doctors hated him. They didn't want anything to do with it. It took too much time. It was too inconvenient. Let us get on with our daily routines. It doesn't make a difference. They hated him. Now, the death rate plunged to a mere 1%. They still hated him. So much so that they fired him. You know, you don't fix a problem, get rid of the problem maker, I suppose. They fired him. They got rid of him. So the medical establishment, they were enraged. They fired him. They put him out, hopefully to pasture, let him, you know, he would quit. Well, he didn't, and that's good, because he went on and got hired by another medical institution. And this medical institution was in another country. And again, he saw this same thing happening there. So with a little bit of studying and observation, he found that they needed this hand-washing regimen. So he instituted it. You know what happened? They fired him. It wasn't until Pasteur confirmed the germ theory years later that Dr. Semmelweis's idea was endorsed by all the doctors. How many deaths occurred that were needless? But centuries before this, God had something to say about all this. Numbers chapter 19, we'll just take a quick look there. Numbers chapter 19, the chapter itself talks about the laws of purification. I mean, God knows what he's talking about. When he says something, he means it. Verse 11, I just want to, just a quick little verse there. Numbers 19, verse 11 says, "He who touches the dead body of anyone shall be unclean 7 days. Now, I don't want to take the time to read all of chapter 19. You should do this, and it's a good study, because there's a lot more that goes with this. But the people of Israel, they observed these laws. Without understanding a lot about germs and bacteria and viruses, but in obeying these simple laws and rules, they avoided many of the plagues and diseases that troubled these other nations. Now, it goes back to obeying God's laws. Obeying God's laws in the little things. We might not understand everything. We have to seek understanding. But we need to obey in the little things as well as the big things. And that's what makes us different from the world. Obeying God. Obeying God's laws. So God here, he brought them to the mountain to receive his laws. The law that would be the basis again of their freedom and the foundation that they could build firmly on. A life that would be profitable. If they obeyed his laws, they would be a free people. But then, just before he gave Israel his laws, God did something. It seemed maybe a little strange when we read it, but we're going to take a look at this. Look at what he told Moses in Exodus 19. Exodus 19, we'll start in verse 10 through 15. Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down from Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people, and you shall set limits for the people all around, saying, take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. There was boundaries. There's boundaries today. But he's saying here, there was boundaries here. Anyone who touches the mountain will die. Israel had to come to the mountain where their freedom would be the basis of God's laws. And that's absolutely a marvelous thing. It's a great thing. We as Americans celebrate our freedom by the setting off of fireworks. Now, maybe tonight or tomorrow night or even Monday night, probably most of us will go watch fireworks, or we'll see them in some way or another. You know, fireworks is nothing new. God set off fireworks. Does that surprise you? Well, let's read here in Exodus 20. See what they say here. Exodus 20, verses 18 and 19. Breaking into his thought here, Exodus 20, verse 18. When all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and all the sounds of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and they trembled. And they stood far off and they said to Moses, you speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die. It scared them. Scared them to death. Now, I enjoy a good fireworks show, and I'm sure most of you do too. But you think about it. The young kids, the young babies, most of them do not appreciate the thundering booms of a firecracker or a huge firework that goes up and explodes over your head. They don't appreciate the sky turning red and green and purple. These people, these children of Israel, they didn't appreciate this. They were babies in Christ. They didn't appreciate it. Scared them. God sets off fireworks, but they are so scary that the people here, they trembled. They worried for their lives. You got to think about it for a minute. You know, where are we at here? This was the base of a mountain. This was the place of the foundation of Israel's freedom, right? This was their new beginning. Where's their celebration? Where's their excitement? Where's their festivities? They were scared. Why on earth would God create such an ominous and scary atmosphere so he could give his laws? Well, a law intended for freedom here and blessings to Israel, it needed to make a statement. One that they would remember forever. Not just for their life, but forever. I can think of at least two reasons why God might do it this way, and I'm sure there's others. But number one, God knew their heart. God knows our heart. But God knew their heart. One point while Israel was still in the desert that I want to make here, Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 7. This is what Moses told them. Moses knew their heart too, for a certain extent. But God really knew it. Deuteronomy 9, verse 7. Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day that you departed from the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord. Wow. everything that God did for them, simply breaking them out of Egypt in a land where they were abused, to say the least. God sent in Moses. God got them out of there. God performed miracle after miracle after miracle all the way to the base of the mountain. And this here says, from the day that you departed from the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord. And God still was going to give them their freedom. What a loving and merciful God that we serve. God knew their hearts. He knew that they'd been hard-hearted and they'd been rebellious. He knew that they'd provoked him by their behavior. He knew who they were. And so when he brought them to the base of the mountain to receive the commandments, he put on a very impressive light and sound show. A show that, again, would let them know that, listen here, people, I am God. You are not. And I don't ever want you to forget it. And I'm sure they never did. We're still talking about this episode today. He was telling them that these commandments that he was about to give them, they were just that. They were commandments. They were not suggestions. They were not the 10 suggestions. Do what you want, if you want. They didn't get a vote on them. And they didn't get a pick and choose which ones they wanted to keep and which ones they didn't. They were still, or they were and are still God's laws, God's commandments. And it was and it is still all or nothing. He says, if you break one of them, you're guilty of all of them. We are to keep all of them. If they wanted God's freedom, if they wanted that foundation to grow on, to base their life, their new life on, then they had to take God's laws, all of them. You couldn't leave any of them out. But why say it to them this way? Why make this kind of statement? Well, when you think about that, people in general, and this is the average person, they tend to bend the rules a little bit. They tend to bend the rules to work it out for their own advantage. And these people were no different. A while back, Reader's Digest had an article, and it was about cheating. The article discussed what prompted people to cheat. You know, why are they cheating? What do they gain from it? And how do they justify it? According to Josephson Institute, those with power, or those in positions of authority, or even a better office space. Now, these are facts they took. Felt like they had the right to steal or cheat. Those who hung around with others that would cheat or steal, they were more likely to do so. Kind of peer pressure thing. Those who felt that another person had cheated often felt that it was only fair that they take from them. Kind of the Robin Hood syndrome, I guess. And those who had gotten used to the minor infractions, the minor cheatings, they almost 100% of the time grew into larger ones. Rule breaking, it worsens over time. And we all know this. Kids who cheat on high school exams are 3 times likely in adulthood to lie to their customers or inflate an insurance claim, as compared to the non-cheaters. It builds. What I found interesting in this article was an admission by a behavioral economist by the name of Dan Ariely. He's from Duke University. He was involved in this study. This section of that study was buried very, very deep in the article, but this is what Ariely noted. He said, quote, if test subjects were made to recall the Ten Commandments before a test, they were less likely to cheat. Wow. Think about that. And this is not talking about Christians, as we are Christians. This is talking about society. If they were made to recall the Ten Commandments, they were less likely to cheat. What's that say about writing God's law in our heart and our mind? In other words, when people simply were made to think about God and think about God's laws and how they affect our life, they would be less likely to justify doing the wrong thing. Their tendencies to do the right thing would outweigh them, would cause them to change their path or their direction. That was the power of the living Word of God, and it will absolutely alter our minds. God knew the heart of these Israelites. He knows all of our hearts. He knows what our will is. You know, we know what we want to do, and we know what we need to do. The question is, are we strong enough or courageous enough to do it? God knows our hearts, and that's the reason that He made such an imposing and frightening display at the bottom of this mountain. He brought it to their attention, something they would never forget. The second reason He may have done this was that He knew Israel's freedom under the law was not total freedom. It was not total freedom. Now, we already read this, but I want to quote it again, Exodus 19, verses 12 and 13. Exodus 19, verse 12 and 13. Remember what He said here. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, take heed to yourself that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. Not a hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot with an arrow. Whether man or beast, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain. The Israelites were not allowed to touch the mountain. I'm sure that we have all read through this before and seen this. By this time, it kind of caught my attention, and it made me realize a couple things. They're not allowed to touch the mountain. Why? Well, number one, whose mountain is it? It's God's. God is on this mountain. God is present there. In other cultures and nations, people would honor their pagan gods by building altars on high places. And this still goes on today. Why would they do that? Well, they do this so they can, in theory, get to the highest point. They want to get closer to their God. And it makes sense if you think about it. But God didn't want Israel to build the altar here. Look at Deuteronomy 12, verse 2 and 4. Deuteronomy 12, verses 2 through 4. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains, on the high hills, and under every green tree. And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their god and destroy their name from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. Why not? Well, because Israel didn't belong where God was, not at the same place. God is totally holy and pure. They weren't. Even after they received the law, their sin that they had still made them unable to get real close to God, as close as we need to be. The law couldn't make them acceptable to God in that way. Look what Paul wrote in Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3, verse 11. But that no one is justified by the law in the sight of God is evident, for the just shall live by faith. Said another way, it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law, for the righteous shall live by faith. It's another translation. In other words, the law could help one be a better person, and it was the way to live, and is the way to live. But the law in itself can't get us closer to God. I hope that doesn't shock anybody. We must remember that we all, every one of us, sinned. We do sin, and we continue to sin. We fall short of the glory of God. Keeping rules and depending on our own self-righteousness will not, absolutely will not, give us the right to come that close to God. We have to be clean. We have to change. There has to be something happen in our life. Hebrews 11, my dad talked about it a little bit in the sermonette, is the faith chapter. And it's called a faith chapter because it tells of all the great men and women in the past who had the faith, who kept the faith. The Old Testament people, they realized, even part of the New Testament people, they realized that they weren't going to see Christ return. But they were okay with that because they had the faith to know that what was coming at the very end of the age was what their hope was anyway. We all have that same hope, the same faith. But at the end of this chapter, we're told this. Notice Hebrews chapter 11, verse 40. Hebrews 11, verse 40. God had planned something better for us, Christians, so that only together with us should they, talking about these saints that we just read about or talked about, should they be made perfect. Be made perfect. We're not perfect yet, but we have the hope. And we have the desire, and that is the direction we are on. We are to work to come to perfection. The Old Testament Christians or saints or whatever you want to say it, they were absolutely great people. But they lacked the one thing that we did have the opportunity to have. And that is Christ physically walking with us and then spiritually in our lives. Earlier in Hebrews, we're told of one of the important advantages of having Christ in our life. So Hebrews 10, if you will. Hebrews 10 and verse 16. Hebrews 10, verse 16 through 22. This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws into their hearts and in their minds. I will write them. Then he adds, their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more. Now, where there is remission of these, there is no longer an offering for sin. Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus Christ, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us, through the veil, that is, his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Did you catch that? He said, we get to draw near to God. That's what we need. It's what we want, but it's what we need. Because of Jesus Christ, we have the confidence, or we should have the confidence. We need to have the confidence to enter the most holy place and boldly approach God the Father at his throne. We have that invitation. We need to do it. The Israelites at Mount Sinai, they were not allowed to even touch the mountain. But now, because of the blood of Jesus Christ, the sacrifice that he and the Father made, you and I, we don't have that restriction. We can do this. And that gives us the freedom that we have that the rest of the world doesn't have. We get to get up close and personal with God. He invites us to do that. Brother, I hope that we can see exactly why we cannot, and I repeat that, we cannot take our calling for granted. That is a sin. We can't do it. But not because we've kept a bunch of laws and rules and try to live a clean life, which we are and we have. We come into the presence of God only because of what God the Father has done, what Jesus Christ has done. They've created that newness in our life. Look at Romans chapter 6. Romans chapter 6. It says here that when we're buried in the water of baptism, it talks about what happens here. Romans 6 and verse 4. It says, therefore, we were buried with him through baptism into death, that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. Freedom, foundation, set on the laws of God, on the way of life of God. Let's follow this up in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17, it tells us that when that happens, what we just read in Romans 6, then this. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. We've given a new start. Absolutely incredible. In thinking about Independence Day, which is coming up here in just a few days, and the 4th of July and what it stands for, and some of the things we talked about in the very beginning, we'd start to realize or ask the question, where are we today in modern society? Where is the world? Where is America? And it brings me to one final question. And this question is it too late? Is it too late? Is it too late for America? Is it too late for us as people, Americans? Only God has the answer, because only God knows how far we've gone, literally, and only God knows when His return will be. But there are some interesting passages that I want to call to your attention. It concerns the evil king Manasseh, but go to 2 Chronicles chapter 33, if you will. We start to wind down on this last question here. 2 Chronicles 33, verse 10. Notice what it says here. The Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they would not listen. They wouldn't listen. How many times have we seen this? Manasseh and the people of Judah didn't listen to God. They didn't care, obviously, what God had to say. God spoke to them again and again. You know, God is not quick to dismiss us. He will hang in there as long as we will. He came back and again and even warned them, but they just didn't listen. Let's go on here in verse 11. It says this, therefore the Lord brought upon them the captains of the armies of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh with hooks, bound him with bronze fetters, and carried him off to Babylon. Now when he was in affliction, he implored the Lord his God, and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. And he prayed to him, and he received his entreaty, heard his supplication, and brought him back to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. I think it's very interesting here that even though God would ultimately destroy Judah, when Manasseh here, this king that was not the nicest in the world, he acknowledged God. He acknowledged him. And in sincerity, he humbled himself and he repented of his sins. God accepted him. God accepted his repentance, and then God forgave him. Absolutely outstanding. But for our nation, is it too late? Have we gone too far? Have we already reached the point of no return? As far as our standards and morals go, it makes you wonder. We've taken God out of everything. We've taken Him out of the schools. It's just a matter of time, it seems, before they take Him out of the churches. Have we gone too far? Many other nations before us have done the same thing. They've been on this downward spiral, and I think we're on this downward spiral. I hope that the people would realize, would snap out of it and stand up, but only God knows. We're in 2 Chronicles. Go to 2 Chronicles 7. 2 Chronicles 7, because this is more of God's promises. 2 Chronicles 7, verse 14. It says, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sins and will heal their land. Maybe there's still time. I don't know. God knows. God knows the heart of us. He knows the heart of every American out there. He knows His plan in detail. the thing about it is, the people, the person, the individual has to make the choice, the conscious choice to turn their heart and life around to the way of God, to live, to base their life on those laws. Will they do it? It doesn't look very promising. How is it that God could take someone or some people who have really messed up their lives so bad and make them new again? Well, I want to close with this illustration. And this comes back from the days of Queen Victoria in England. Victoria, she would on a regular basis visit businesses and houses of all her subjects. And she did this in a way that they would have no idea who she was. On one such occasion, she paid a visit to a paper mill. Now, the foreman knew that this distinguished guest was coming, but they didn't know who she was. They didn't know her true identity. So he took her in, and he showed her and her attendants all through the plant. And they walked in one room and another, and they saw different types of production. And they came to this room where there was a lot of trash and a lot of garbage. And they noticed a man was going through this trash and garbage and pulling out some of the dirtiest rags that were there. So she asked, "Why is he doing this? What's the point here?" And the foreman told her, he said, "Ma'am," he said, "with these dirtiest rags that are there, we can make the finest white writing paper available." And she was amazed. Well, she left, she went home. It wasn't long after her departure that she got a package in the mail. And this package was a very nicely wrapped gift of white, pure white stationery. And on it, it had a watermark. And the watermark said, "The Queen's Likeness." A letter explained that this stationery that she just received had been made from all those piles and piles of absolutely dirty, filthy rags from that plant. The process that they used to turn this, what seemed to be old, dirty, corruptible, if you will, worthless piece of rags into white stationery worthy of a queen was phenomenal. And that illustrates Jesus Christ's work in all of us. He is able to take the filthy, dirty, corruptible, if you will, rags that we once were, and make that transformation into this new creature, this new creation that's worthy of a king. Worthy of a king. And when that happens, we are as different as that dirty rag was before it became a stationery. We're as pure, as clean as that white stationery that said "The Queen's Likeness." Once again, happy birthday, America. We look at our currency, and we still today, don't know how much longer, but still today, we see the motto, "In God We Trust." Americans need to learn to transfer that motto from the money to their hearts. We must remember that as we prepare to celebrate Independence Day in just a few days, no nation on earth will long endure, absolutely will not, if they do not depend on God. How can we transfer this motto, "In God We Trust," from our coins to our hearts? We're not going to turn there, but a good study is Psalms 33, and it coincides with one of our hymns, "Blessed is the nation God is for." I think that's where the answer lies. I think when you see this, you'll see some principles that we would do extremely well to observe and put into our life, because we are blessed to be a free nation, to be free people, to have the laws of God written on our hearts and on our minds. Brethren, I hope you all have a wonderful 4th of July, a true Independence Day.